It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Serba.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
There is shot, rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
A good Monday morning. How is it going? Hopefully you're getting your week started off on the right foot. You are listening to Rintoul and Serba. I'm Karen Serba. Scott does have the day off, a scheduled day off. I'm sure he'd love to be here today to rub something in to me and Jamie Dodd. If you haven't been listening to the show, well, we'll explain a little bit later as we go on. Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott Rintoul today. Jamie, how are you doing? How was your weekend?
My weekend was great. I mean, obviously, we'll get to it. The result in Euro didn't go exactly the way I wanted. I feel like I have to put the caveat out there that I'm probably a more casual England supporter than you are, Karen. So I'm more concerned about you and your mental state after the crushing defeat for England yesterday.
It is funny. I have mentioned on air, and I'm not going to back away from this. I am a casual England supporter every 2 years, but I get into it when it comes to the 2 years. I don't really, you know, pay attention to the qualifiers and all that kind of stuff, just making sure England does qualify for the major tournaments. But I'm okay. Let's put it that way. I'm okay only because I do know that I have a bet coming up with Scott Rintoul. We'll get into that. But Jamie, it's not coming home. Nope, it's going to Rome. Kudos to Italy. Heartbreak in a new fashion for England. I think we probably all expected that if you've supported England over the years. For me, you, Jamie, well, we'll try and not mention the other guy's name on the show today too much. He's a little happier than we are. 53 years in the making for Italy when that country last won its European Championship. The wait still continues for England. You could say that it was an accomplishment to finally get back to any championship final in 1966. Jamie, that's a long time ago.
Yep.
But unfortunately, I don't think this accomplishment will be celebrated. It should, but when you're not lifting the trophy in the end and you're England and the expectations and at home, it just won't be celebrated. So many bright spots for this side going forward. So many lights that may shine bright for this Three Lions team moving tournament to tournament. But on the day, it was pure devastation, pure heartbreak, and pure sadness for those young lads. Congrats to Italy. It's hard to argue that they weren't the best team throughout the entire tournament. And it's hard to argue they weren't the best team on Sunday championship day, but it's a championship deserved, well-earned. If you weren't playing England, it probably could say it was a joy to watch that Italian squad on the pitch. They're really fun. And just a joy. They made the game look beautiful at times. So congratulations to Italy. I'll take the high road on this one, even if my stomach will not be taking the high road. Or maybe it will. I don't know how you put that together when I have to run the beer mile in about a week's time. So your initial thoughts, Jamie, after watching that match yesterday?
Well, I mean, didn't the result end up, it seemed kind of inevitable, right? I mean, even for a lot of England supporters, I think if you had told them, yeah, it's going to end with Italy winning on penalty kicks, they probably would have said, yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, we had a couple of guests on the show last week, Karen. Brendan Morrison. Both predicted. Now, I think Brendan Morrison even got the score correctly and predicted that Italy would win in PKs, and Craig Forrest said the same thing, right? So it's not that surprising of a result. And I don't know about you, but it kind of felt inevitable. You know, obviously England scores the early goal and that's great. Okay, they're up 1-0. They just need to hold on. But it almost came too early in the match. And then they said, okay, we're just going to shut it down. And you just can't do that against a side like Italy. Like, that was never going to work. And then as soon as Italy equalized, which you could see coming a mile away, right? Like, they were dominating play for long stretches before that. As soon as they equalized, you thought, okay, this is probably going to go to penalty kicks. And, I mean, we know what Italy can do in penalty kicks, and we know what England historically has done in big moments in penalty kicks. And just, it was, I would have been stunned. I would have been really stunned if England had gone on to victory at that point.
So, as you mentioned, Jamie, just to give our listeners, if for whatever reason you don't know what happened in the match yesterday, England scores really early in the second minute of the game. Luke Shaw, the unlikely scorer, the defender. It was a beautiful touch by him. The nice half volley, the beautiful pass by Trippier into the box. Wembley's in a frenzy, all the English supporters that were there. And then about the 30th minute, I don't know, Jamie, if that's where it turned for you, but for me, that's where I kind of like, okay, Italy's found their groove. And yep. They basically controlled the match from there on out. Italian goal was inevitable. 67th minute, Leonardo Bonucci heaves with the tying goal. Extra time, as you said, provided no goal, so it went to penalty kicks. 3-2 by Italy. So we're watching this, and Jordan Pickford makes the initial save, right? And you're thinking, okay, like,
yep.
It sucks to shoot second in penalty kicks, and actually history is not on your side if you shoot second. I think it's about 60% of the time the first shooting team wins, and every team in this Euro tournament who shot first won. Like, that's the crazy stat out of all of this. So Jordan Pickford makes the early save, and then you're thinking Harry Kane scores and Maguire scores, and they're pretty confident penalty kicks for England. Like, they look like veterans. They look like guys that knew what they were doing, and then it just kind of started to fall off, and you've got Rashford who misses, and then Sancho misses, and then the poor Saka misses. But Jordan Pickford also makes a save right before Saka has his kick, and you're thinking, okay, two saves, incredible saves by the English keeper. That's all you can ask for in this situation, and you're putting a 19-year-old kid, sadly, in the crosshairs of the enormity of this moment. And for him, sadly, the goalkeeper came up with a very good save, but for him, it was just too much, and England goes home. It's just, yeah, it's another way they just crushed the dreams of English supporters.
Yeah, well, as to your point, I mean, Pickford did his job, right? Like, two stops in penalty kicks against Italy. That's, you can't ask for anything more than that. I mean, the problem is, before we even get to the English players taking the kicks, you know, you got to give some credit to the other side as well. Donnarumma for Italy, one of the best goaltenders in the world at stopping penalty kicks, right? So he is extremely well-suited for that task, and he showed why in the game, in the match last night. But, you know, if we're going to talk about the penalty kick specifically, and here's the thing, as you said, the team shooting first tends to win about 60% of the time. It's so random. It's such a coin flip. But you also kind of have to point the finger at Gareth Southgate a little bit, right? And I mean, you know, as you said, the first two guys up, Harry Kane, Harry Maguire, they make it count. Fantastic penalties from both of them. But even as this was happening, right, when he subs on Marcus Rashford and Jadon Sancho right just before the end of extra time, basically in the 120th minute of the match, you know he's subbing them on to take penalties. That had me scratching my head. And I'm interested. I'm curious to get the perspective from the listeners. Text in 650, 650 or 960, 960 in Calgary. And I'm curious to talk to James Sharman a little bit in the show later on. But I was just really surprised by that. You're subbing these guys in cold. They're barely going to get a touch on the ball. If they're lucky enough to get a touch on the ball, you're basically asking them for their first touch, their first action to be an incredibly high pressure penalty, right? In a final of a major tournament at Wembley. And I'm not really that surprised that neither guy was able to convert. That's just such a difficult position to put them in.
So not only are your legs cold, but your brain's cold too, right? Like, you just aren't in the competition that the other guys have been in for the 90 minutes and then the extra 30 minutes of the extra time. And like, the only reason, like, he was substituted them on so late. So the only reason they got on was luckily a late corner kick by Italy, or else these two wouldn't have been subbed on because he was holding them out so late. I don't understand why, maybe not putting them in earlier, letting them get their legs, maybe even, hey, let's go try and win the game in extra time and not have to go to penalty kicks. Because if you're Gareth Southgate, you're going, yeah, I know that we overcame it against Colombia in the World Cup, but the history against England in penalty kicks is not exactly on our side. So I'm thinking to myself, why don't you go win it up there in regulation or in added time, as this may be.
Karen, go ahead. You know what? Just to your point, I mean, yeah, okay, after England scored, and as you said, turning in about the 30th minute, Italy dominated that game. But I actually thought in extra time, it was pretty even, and England created some chances, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't on their back foot for the entire period, the entire 30 minutes of extra time. So as you're saying, why not try to take advantage of that? You actually found a little bit of extra life in extra time. Go out and try to find the goal, right? Don't wait for penalty kicks. Don't just shrug and say, well, I guess this is going to go to penalty kicks and we have to plan for that. I would have liked to see a little bit more aggression in extra time in particular.
And I point to this too, and the announcers made a good point. When Grealish came on, I think he came on around the 80th minutes, Jamie, if I'm not mistaken, around that point in the match. I actually thought, well, why don't you bring him on sooner? Because when Italy came out in the second half, I'm thinking, okay, tactically, Gareth Southgate has to make some changes because you saw Italy gain traction towards the end of the first half. I thought, okay, something has to give. It didn't. Italy had full-on control in that second half. I think possession at one point was like 80-something or was 77 to 23. Like, it was just embarrassing to one side. And I'm thinking, okay, well, why don't you make a tactical change and bring in some offensive players? And Grealish has been incredible all tournament. He's been dynamic out there. He gives them a more offensive front foot presence. And as soon as you came on and in added time, you saw it. The announcer said they should be getting him the ball almost every opportunity that they can, because once it's on his foot, it looks like something's happening. Southgate didn't. And again, we'll get into James Sharman a little bit more about this, because I do want to know the tactics of Gareth Southgate. A lot of people have actually been questioning him throughout the entire tournament, but when you're winning, it doesn't really matter, right? So what do we think about the fact that he did decide to go into a bit of a shell when you have a lead with, 87 minutes left to go in a game?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he didn't even bring Grealish on until extra time, right? Into well into extra time, right? I think the 99th minute. So
was that when he finally brought him in? Okay,
yes,
that's cool.
Yeah. I know, like, it was a long, long time into the game before he brought Jack Grealish on. And throughout this entire tournament, every time Grealish has gotten on the pitch, every time he's had the ball, basically, he's looked like he's going to create a chance, right? And for whatever reason, Gareth Southgate has been reluctant to give him big minutes at this tournament. I find the discussion around Southgate really, really fascinating right now, because you're right. I mean, almost every decision he made at this tournament faced a lot of criticism. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like every time, you know, the English Football Association, they put out the tweet 2 hours before the game of this is how we're lining up. And you look at the replies and the quote tweets, and it's just people being like, what are we doing? Why is this the lineup we're selecting? How is he leaving Sancho on the bench? Why is Mason Mount playing? All of this, right? There's all of this criticism every time he made a lineup decision, but it worked. And a lot of times it wasn't even lucky that it worked. It was, oh, okay, I see the game plan he was going for, and the players were able to execute it, and it worked out, and he got them all the way to the final. So You kind of didn't want to second guess him, but then looking at how it played out yesterday, there's two big issues, right? One is, as you say, going into the shell that early. And I think what happened there is, again, they almost scored too early. Like, the plan was obviously play it tight, play it close, commit to defense, get a goal on the counterattack, and then try to shut them down. I just don't think they expected to have to do that for 87 minutes. So that's probably a little bit more than they were bargaining for. And maybe you could say, well, then you got to adjust on the fly. You got to come up with a new game plan. But the bigger one for me is the strategy and penalties, right? Like, that is, if I'm going to levy criticism at Gareth Southgate for anything, that's what I'm choosing, because I just don't think he put his team, his side, in the best position to win that game.
And Greg, let's hear from Gareth Southgate right now, because he did take basically all the responsibility after the match on the penalties, because he said, this is my call to put these five guys out here.
Yeah, but what they have to know is that, you know, none of them are on their own. We win and lose as a team. And the penalty takers are my call. You know, we've worked on them in training. That's my decision. That's not down to the players. And tonight it hasn't gone for us. But we know they were the best takers that we had left on the pitch. We tried to get those players onto the pitch. We'd already had to take a couple off during the game itself. Yeah, of course, it's going to be heartbreaking for the boys, but they're not to blame for that. That's my call as the coach.
So Jeff and North Van, the players Southgate had selected were his best penalty kick takers, not a random choice at this level. Okay, I understand that. And Jamie, we've all heard, like, he does penalty kicks in practice and training all the time, and he takes the guys that look the best and have the best percentage in taking penalty kicks and training. But that's training. And this is Wembley, and this is the Euro Cup final, and this is 19-year-old kids, one who had just come onto the pitch, another one who was a substitute as well in Saka. But so here's my thinking on this. You step up with Harry Kane, you step up with Harry Maguire, and they both make it. Why? I don't say let's move Hain to the back at number five spot, because sometimes the number five kicker doesn't even get to go. You don't want to leave a Harry Kane in a situation where he's not even kicked. And then you're saying to Gareth Southgate, well, this is wrong. Like, Harry Kane has to kick penalty shots. Okay, I'm okay with him going first and second. It's just there were other guys on the pitch that had a lot more experience in international play that I was thinking – okay, like this moment for them, and not even international play, playing with their club teams, playing in championship games and, you know, in the Premier League or in Champions League and all these other situations, I'm thinking to myself, there has to be a better situation. And this is why. Gareth Southgate wore that missed penalty kick for the entirety of the rest of his life, and he's still trying to overcome that to this date. I don't want these kids who are going to be the cornerstone for English football going forward, two of them at least, in Sancho and Saka, who both missed, to have to wear the brunt of that. It just strikes me as Gareth Southgate probably should have known better. That's where I'm going.
Yeah, it's so tough for those players because they were put in an impossible situation again that they probably shouldn't have been put in, just from the outside looking in. And it's so interesting because, as you said, you know, Gareth Southgate, his career was defined by failing. His career as a player for England was defined by failing in penalty kicks in a situation like this. And as the English manager, he's really tried to kind of bury that history, right? And I know they've devoted a ton of time to the psychology of it, right? To trying to overcome the pressure and the stress of that moment. They've really, really basically rethunk the way they approach penalties as an English squad. They had the triumph against Colombia, as you mentioned, in the last World Cup. A lot of people said, okay, can they put the past behind them? And again, it just feels like the approach was wrong in this instant. You know, to the texter's point, I can accept that. Look, those are their best penalty kick takers. Those are the guys that have to be there. But if you know you're going to rely on Rashford and Sancho to take penalties, I just think you have to get them into the game earlier, right? You either have to go with somebody else or you say these are our best guys and you got to figure out a way to get them on the pitch with more than a minute left in the game or 30 seconds left in the game.
This one, Chris and Abby. Southgate subbed off Henderson, a Champions League and Premier League winning captain, and replaced him with a 19-year-old for penalties. That's not good coaching. Yep, you can call him for that. Absolutely.
Yep. I think that's a very, very fair point.
Exactly. Just someone who understands the pressure of the moment. Like, these kids just, I felt terrible for them. And Jamie, we can get into the online abuse and the hate being thrown at them. My first thought was when these kicks were missed and you got the 2 19-year-olds, my first thought initially was, oh my goodness, they're going to have to wear this for the rest of their careers, or at least trying to, for the rest of their careers, make up for this, right? Like Gareth Southgate had to. And then you go online and then you see the trolls and then you see the responses, and they were the racial hate thrown at them by a, I hope to say minority, but a loud minority of English supporters. It was disheartening to see. Not surprising, though, but disheartening.
Yeah, it's awful. Again, as you said, not surprising, which is, in a way, the most disheartening part of it, right? But it was certainly extremely disheartening. We should mention, overall, not a great day for English supporters, right? I don't just mean because of the loss, but you saw the scenes outside of Wembley. There was an awful lot of violence happening. It's, you kind of come to expect it with England. There's always this hope that it's moved beyond the hooligan culture, right? And it's certainly gotten better than I know it was 30 or 40 years ago. But yeah, it was not a banner day for English football culture. Let's put it that way yesterday.
But here's the thing. I don't know if it has because of social media, and now it just gets louder and the voices just get you can hide behind a keyboard and throw it out there on Twitter and throw it out there on Instagram. And then it's like, It's a different kind of vocal, I guess you could say, than it was 30 years ago. Yes, fans who didn't have tickets tried to storm Wembley. I saw security guards like tripping people, trying to push them over with the hopes of trying to avoid a disastrous situation. You saw people partying in the streets and drinking. Like, this match started at 9 o'clock local time. So you've got your entire day leading up to the match. I can only imagine what time pubs were open. And yes, we can talk about alcohol in probably inducing a lot of this too, but there's still a lot of angry people that would do these things without any alcohol to help them out. But did you see the video of a guy decided to pull his pants down and put a flare in a certain area?
I sure did.
And I'm going, yes, because that makes sense. This is going to go wrong. But this is like where we're going with the celebrations, if that's what this is called, right? And then, you know, during the match, there's videos because the Italy fans that were there, they had to stay in a bubble, right? Because of the restrictions going into and out of the UK right now. So they were chartered in from Italy. They had to sit all in the same section. There were spots in actually Wembley where they couldn't go. Like, it was cordoned off just for Italy supporters so that they didn't mix with England fans. And then England fans got into that section and were basically like just beating on Italian fans. Like, it was just, this is the reason why the majority of the world hates English football. It's not necessarily you hate the English football players. You hate the fandom.
Yeah, and a text on that point comes in right now, 650-650. The text message inbox says, the hatred is revolting. As an Englishman, it's incredibly depressing, and I can absolutely understand why people love to see us lose. And yeah, I mean, it's all just as if fans of English football needed another reason to feel down right after yesterday's match.
Right.
Like, it just puts such a sour note to end the tournament, which had been such an incredible run for the team, right? And playing their games at Wembley and being able to celebrate with their home crowd, right, after all of their wins. It's a tough way for the tournament to end. I want to read a few more texts coming in at 650-650. Keep those takes coming in, 960-960 as well. I enjoyed this one. Unsigned says, English soccer is like Charlie Brown and Lucy. Just when you think Charlie Brown, England, is going to kick the ball, Lucy, in this case Italy, pulls it away at the last minute. Yeah, and I'll admit, and I'm someone who said that as soon as it went to penalty kicks, you know, okay, this is over, England's going to lose. But they did take the lead in penalty kicks, right? And Pickford got an early save, and they were out in front. And I will admit, I allowed myself to feel like a moment of hope. And oh my goodness, is England actually going to get this monkey off their backs? I will admit, I was thinking that. Even I, who am very, very pessimistic when it comes to England, allowed myself just a glimmer of hope.
So I'm watching the shootouts out of the corner of my eye. I've got a pillow up, kind of looking at my boyfriend and kind of like looking around the pillow. Like, you know, you don't want to watch, but I got to watch it because I don't want to miss if it's good or bad. And like you said, when England got the lead there, I was like, okay, I can watch. Not a good situation towards the end. Hey, we can talk about England all we want, and we will with James Sharman as this show goes on. He's going to join us in the third hour of our show, bottom of the third hour. But we have to give Italy credit, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You do. And to the English side, like, congratulations. It's your first Euro title since 1968, where you won it at home. It's also your first international title since winning, what was it, the 2008 World Cups? 2006, there you go.
Yeah.
World Cup. So good on Italy. If I'm able to take my England fandom out of it, and I think I can just by looking at it, like, it was fun to watch them play. Right? Like when they were pressing and had all that control of the ball, it just did. It looked phenomenal. It looked like they were never concerned about England coming back, and they just decided to say, hey, we're going to go on the front foot. And I understand they're down 1-0. They have to score. But if you can look at it from the Italy side of things, it was really fun to watch.
Yeah, and when just before we started talking about this, Karen, we had this text come into Calgary, 960-960, says, all this talk about England and Southgate, where's the love for Italy? Best team all tournament, better team on Sunday, 34-match unbeaten streak, and deserving champions. It's coming to Rome. Forza Azzurri is how he ends the text. And I agree. I mean, they were the best team in the tournament. They were certainly the better team yesterday. Yeah, they win in penalties, but they were very deserving overall. And, you know, I want to give a shout-out. All the talk about this Italy team has been how, you know, okay, they don't just sit back and defend. They get forward. They have these creative players. They're a lot different than past Italy teams. But I do want to give some love to two of the veterans on the teams, the two center backs in Chiellini and Bonucci, who were incredible all tournament. Great personalities as well. I mean, Giorgio Chiellini, I think, is like the breakout star just for his behavior and penalty kicks at various points in this tournament. But they were fantastic yesterday. Bonucci gets the goal. Great work defending as well. It's interesting because they're kind of holdovers from the past generation of Italian soccer, but they were fantastic in this tournament.
Can I say Chiellini? He's lucky to have still stayed in that match. Like, that was a freaking horse collar that he had, and he knew he was lucky because he went and he kissed his wrist.
Yep.
I'm sure he has a tattoo there. I don't know if a cross or a saint or something like that, but he knew he was very lucky to remain in that match. Okay, we're going to dive into this a little bit later in the show. We're going to switch some gears here, and I promise we will talk hockey. That's going to come up in the second hour of the show. We're going to get into the Canucks and Flames offseason. So if you want to start getting your submissions in, 650, 650, and 960, 960, kind of what your most successful or ideal off seasons look like for the Canucks and look like for the Calgary Flames, because Jamie, I think we can both agree that these two teams probably have the most changes coming this off season. Nothing's happened yet. It's been pretty quiet, but there is question marks surrounding what needs to be done and what can be done.
Yeah, and we're just going to hit the super, super busy stretch of the NHL offseason coming up over the next 2 weeks here. So I'm curious to hear from the fans. Yeah, what would they consider, whether you're a Flames fan or Canucks fan, what would you consider an ideal, successful offseason for your team?
So get those in, text us as always. But up next, we're going to focus on a little baseball because we reached the halfway point of the season. Jamie, the Midsummer Classic just around the corner. That is tomorrow from Denver. But tonight it's the Home Run Derby. And all eyes are on Shohei Ohtani and the thin air at Coors Field and what the heck kind of show he's going to put on. We're going to speak to Dan Shulman, the voice of the Blue Jays. He is coming up next right here on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Mike in Victoria just wants to remind everybody that he called it last week, Jamie, and knew that I was going to lose my bet. Yes, we'll get into the bet a little bit later in the show, but Mike in Victoria just wanted to point out a couple times, texted to the inbox, Jamie saying, I knew you'd be wrong. England would lose. Italy would come out on top.
Hold on. I get the desire to gloat, but you don't need a crystal ball to predict England losing in a major tournament final. So, like, I get it, but it's not this crazy. Wow, I saw this coming when nobody else did. Like, yeah, no, a lot of people saw this coming.
Quickly, just before we get into Dan Shulman, he'll be joining us momentarily on our show right here, Rintoul and Sermon. You are listening to Rintoul and Sermon. Scott Rintoul will be back tomorrow. Jamie Dodd filling in for him today. It's the Home Run Derby tonight. We've reached the halfway point of the season, Jamie. All-Star Games tomorrow. I'm not usually a big, like, I'll sit down and watch it, but, you know, there's really actually nothing else going on, so I guess I will sit down and watch it tomorrow. Yep. We hit that point in the summer where it's like, it's baseball or bust. The Gold Cup is going on. Sadly, it's not on two of the major markets, so you kind of have to go digging around to go find that. Canada playing Martinique last night came away with a victory, but there's not much else, so it's going to be a lot of baseball moving forward. Tonight, though, all eyes are on the Home Run Derby. 8 competitors, but everyone is going to be watching for one specifically, and that is Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah, the Home Run Derby reminds me a lot of the Slam Dunk Contest, where it's not must-watch every year, but every so often there will be a guy in the competition that makes you say, okay, well, I have to watch this, right? And this year, that's Shohei Ohtani. You know, I'm not going to say I sit down every year and watch the Home Run Derby from start to finish, but it's appointment viewing for me this year because Shohei Ohtani is going to be in it.
So we've got Shohei Ohtani. He goes into the number one seed. He's going to square off in the first round against Juan Soto for the Nationals. They will face the winner of that will face the winner of Salvador Perez and Pete Alonso. Of course, Pete Alonso going for back-to-back victories. He won in the last Home Run Derby. Joey Gallo, Trevor Story, the hometown kid in Denver. Matt Olson with the A's and Trey Mancini, the sentimental favorite, I think, in this one for the Baltimore Orioles. That's going on tonight. And as we talk about that, we're going to bring in Dan Shulman, Sportsnet play-by-play announcer for the Blue Jays. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty good, Dan. I'm a little disappointed after yesterday's Euro final, but I'm moving on admirably. I'm using this as a cathartic experience talking about it on air to our listeners. The Home Run Derby, going into this one, there's a couple of storylines that we can talk about. The fact that Trevor Story, he's doing it in front of the home fans. Can he be the fourth to do it in front of home fans? Can Pete Alonso win back-to-back? But all eyes are going to be on Shohei Ohtani. What's the expectation of this tonight? He's not a big batting practice guy. He doesn't really like taking it during the regular season, but we all know what he can do during the games. Is this an expectation where he's the favorite going in, but do we want him even to win just based on, you know, sometimes how these home run derbies affect the second half of the season?
I think most people will be rooting for him. And I don't think the average fan worries that much about the second half of the season. And I don't know that the evidence is as overwhelming as the narrative suggests it is. But I think 90% of people watching tonight will be rooting for Ohtani because of how unique he is and how big and strong he is and how far he hits the ball. And he's just a different kind of player than any of us have ever seen before because of what he's doing on both sides of the ball. So, you know, Joey Gallo's a monster and Pete Alonso's a strong guy, and he's already won one of these. So It'll be interesting, but I think all eyes will be on Ohtani. I think the only thing that would have heightened it even more is if Vladimir Guerrero had been in it too, and I totally mm-hmm. respect the fact that he decided not to do it this year. But the home run derby version of like Yankees versus Dodgers or Lakers versus Celtics or anything like that is Vladdy versus Ohtani. That would have been appointment viewing if they had made it to the final.
Dan, we always talk about All-Star games, and we know what the Pro Bowl is like, and probably the best All-Star game is the NBA game, but the NHL has its quirks as well, and baseball no longer has it where you have to, it'll determine the outcome of, well, home field in the World Series, but you got the home run derby, you've got the All-Star game. Like, are these things that we should still be celebrating?
I think so. I like the baseball All-Star game. I think it is the best game of the four because it's actually played like a baseball game. You know, guys who throw 97 still throw 97, and guys swing like they normally swing and try to hit home runs. Like, I love basketball, but there's no defense in an NBA All-Star mm-hmm. game. The score's usually like 174, 168 or something like that. But, I'm a fan of this, and I like that they moved the draft to now. I like that the Futures game was yesterday. I wish it still could be in a bit more of a high-profile window because I think people would love watching it. But I like that these 3 days are kind of like a celebration of the sport. So I'm all in on this, and I never miss an All-Star game. I love watching the All-Star game, and especially with four Blue Jays in it this year. I'm looking forward to it. So, yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm kind of dating myself here, but I remember the early days of the Blue Jays when they would, you know, obviously only get one. They were an expansion team, so they'd get one All-Star. And I'd stay up as late as I could just to see Damaso Garcia or Willie Upshaw or whoever it was announced, you know, let them tip their cap, hope to see their one at-bat before my mother made me go to bed when I was a little kid, that sort of thing. So I'm looking forward to this one, and I think it's great for fans in Canada that they will see, you know, three Blue Jays in the starting lineup and another one coming in as a reserve. And I don't know if we've seen the lineups yet. I'm not sure we have, but, you know, hopefully Vladdy's hitting third. He should be. You know, hopefully he's hitting third or at another prominent spot in the lineup. And I'm all in favor of this. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm excited for a lot of the Blue Jays content as well, Dan. And I want to ask you about the Blue Jays a little bit more in just a second. But, you know, just before we move off the All-Star game and Shohei Ohtani, coming into this season, there was so much talk about, you know, the crop of young stars in Major League Baseball with Vladdy and Fernando Tatis and Ronald Acuna, who unfortunately is out now. But it does seem like Shohei Ohtani has kind of blown past that group of players to become really the face of baseball this season. I think he's kind of passed the litmus test of, you know, people who aren't or maybe casual baseball fans or casual sports fans are asking me about him, and they're hearing like, what's going on with the Shohei Ohtani guy? How important is it for Major League Baseball to have somebody who is kind of dominating the discourse right now to the extent that Shohei Ohtani is?
It's fantastic. I think anything that elevates the popularity of the game and extends the fan base is great. And I would say he is the closest thing to the face of the sport right now, and that's because he's doing something that nobody's done in over a century, and it's fantastic. I don't know if he can keep it up long term. I don't know if anybody else can ever do this, but he's a unicorn, and why shouldn't we celebrate him? And so I think it's great. You know, if he played for a team that was a little bit better or a little bit more high profile, it would get even more attention. But, you know, it is what it is. That doesn't bother me at all. I think he's fantastic for the sport. And I've always said I hope at some point he and Mike Trout are both healthy and having great years at the same time, and that they get a chance to play in October, because they deserve it and the sport deserves it. The sport would be better served if those guys got a chance to play in October. And I'm like you. I have friends who don't know anything about baseball who know who Shohei Ohtani is. And they don't really know anything about his pitching. Like, they don't know that he throws 100. They don't know his numbers or anything like that. They just know that he pitches and hits, and that he hits monster home runs. And that's where the casual fan is. I think the hardcore fan is like, this is unbelievable. Like, how is this guy doing this? And, you know, every time you turn on a highlight show, he's hitting the ball further than he hit one the night before. So I think all of this is fantastic for baseball, and I think it's bringing a lot of fans, and that's great.
And it's a great point about the Angels, right? Because Mike Trout has had to go so long without getting a postseason spotlight, and for at one point for both of them to get that spotlight would really just be fantastic for fans and for the game. I want to move to the Jays a little bit here. You know, obviously, Vladdy Guerrero Jr. has just had an incredible first half, and that's probably the biggest story still when you're talking about the Blue Jays. But outside of that, you know, Robbie Ray just had the fantastic start yesterday. Is Robbie Ray the most pleasant surprise for the Jays so far in the first half outside of Vladdy Guerrero?
I think so. You know, I think a lot of people expected Robbie Ray would be good, that the Blue Jays had found something with him and he had found something with them, and that the two sides wanted to, you know, keep going. So he re-signed to a one-year deal. But I don't know that anybody thought he would be a borderline all-star, which is really what he's been over the first half of the season. You know, what he did yesterday just cemented that. So, yeah, I would say he has been the one of the biggest surprises and one of the most important players they have. I mean, you can make a case right now he's their number one. Like, if the playoffs started tomorrow and the Blue Jays were in it, Robbie Ray might get the ball, not Hyunjin Ryu. And that's really saying something, considering where he was a year ago. So, you know, if you're going to be a good team, you need some pleasant surprises. And Robbie Ray exceeding expectations is definitely one of them. And he looks like he's strong as a horse and can keep doing this for the next 2.5 months. But his command on yesterday was outstanding. Like, he wasn't even pretending to mess around. He was just firing fastballs and striking guys out. And Robbie Ray at his best is pretty impressive.
It's incredible to see the turnaround from the guy who, you know, had one of the highest walk rates in the league not that long ago to the control he's demonstrating on a pretty consistent basis now. We're in conversation with Dan Shulman here on Rintoul and Sermon Sportsnet Radio Network. And, you know, the Jays overall, it's been kind of a frustrating first half. It's been fits and starts, I think, is the best way to put it for the Jays. They haven't really been able to get on that monster run. They're still only a few games out of the wild card race. Do you still look at this team and say that and think that the front office kind of has a duty to go out and add something before the trade deadline to give this group the best chance possible to make the postseason?
I do, but I think sometimes the front office doesn't get credit for what they've done. So, you know, prior to last year, they signed Ryu. At the trade deadline that last year, they made five trades. Five. And then this year in the offseason, Springer and Semien, plus trading for Mats, re-signing Ray, and now they've already made a trade for a couple of relievers. Not stars, but in Adam Simber and Trevor Richards, they've definitely improved the bullpen. So, yes, I think they need to do more, but I don't think the narrative should be they haven't done anything. They've done a lot, but I think basically it's the bullpen. I don't think they're going to go out and get a starting pitcher. I don't think there's enough out there on the market. I think the price will be too high, and I'm not sure they'll get much better than the back end of their rotation now. Could they go out and get a third baseman and make Biggio a super utility guy? They could, but I'm not sure that's where they want to spend that. I'm not sure that's their number one priority. I think their number one priority is preventing runs, and that means shoring up the bullpen. And what I think they need, like, they've done a great job with Simber and Richards of elevating the floor, if you know what I mean. Like, now you're not going to have guys in the sixth inning, seventh inning, eighth inning who shouldn't be there. But I think they need one more high-end reliever, a guy who could almost be like a co-closer with Romano. If Romano's down, you throw the other guy in there. This guy can work the eighth, Romano the ninth, vice versa. I think they need a high-end guy. And I think you got to give up something to get that guy, unless he's a rental, and then you don't have to give up quite as much. But what I'm hoping is that Ryan Barucki's actually going to be healthy, and it sounds like he could be back Thursday. You know, you never want to get too far down that road because he's had so many health issues. But with Simber and Richards, and if Barucki's healthy and they get one more guy, now you're talking about a quality bullpen, and I think that could really spur them on in the second half.
Dan, the first round of the Major League Baseball draft was yesterday. The Jays went number 19 overall. They selected Ole Miss right-hander Gunnar Hoglund, 6'4", 220 pounds. But he did recently have Tommy John surgery. And the likelihood is, if he hadn't have had that, he probably would have been a consensus top 10 pick. They rolled the dice on this guy. Is that because they believe like there is a big upside and they're not worried about the Tommy John?
I think so. That's kind of the vibe that was given last night. And this is the way this front office works, is they like to they don't always do the safe thing. They like to, whether it's in a trade or a free agent signing or even a Rule 5 guy, whatever, they like to go out and get somebody that they think is going to be better than the market thinks they are. So, hey, look at the value we're getting on this guy. And everybody says he would have been a borderline top 10 pick had he not been hurt, and they're counting on him still being that good, obviously coming off of Tommy John surgery. So you know, what this means is the timetable's delayed. I think he just had the surgery in May, if I'm not mistaken. So the earliest he'll start pitching is next May, the earliest. So, like, he's not going to be in the big leagues next year, I don't think. The earliest I think he would ever be in the big leagues is 2023, and that's if everything goes well. But this is the way this front office operates. Like, let's shoot your shot and see if you can get the, you know, as high a ceiling and as much value and that sort of thing. And I do like that they got an arm. They need arms more than they need bats right now. And even though he's hurt, a college arm is going to be, theoretically, be ready for the majors quicker than a high school arm. So people have nothing but good stuff to say about him. He's a command pitcher, not overpowering, but he throws strikes. He's got 2+ pitches, needs to work on the changeup. But it looks like he kind of profiles as a mid-rotation starter, and those are important. Not everybody can be an ace. If you can find a really good number three guy, that helps too.
We're speaking with Dan Shulman, Sportsnet play-by-play announcer for the Toronto Blue Jays. Let's go around a little bit more of the world of baseball. July 31st is coming up. That's the trade deadline, of course. The Cubs are primed to be sellers, and I've been talking to a couple of Cubs fans, and they've kind of come to the realization that the days of Chris Bryant as a Cub are probably likely going to be ended. He's probably one of the biggest name, if not the biggest free agent that could be on the market. He would be a rental because of his contract is up in the offseason, but do you see him on the move, and where do you think he'd be a pretty decent fit?
I think he'd be a fit in a lot of places, although he's cooled off compared to what he was doing at the beginning of the season. But he is still Chris Bryant, and he's a good player, and he can play a bunch of different positions, and that's valuable for teams. And as you said, he's a free agent at the end of the year, so teams that go out and get him won't have to give up as much to get him. If I'm the Cubs, I'm dealing lots of people. You know, Craig Kimbrell, their closer, could be on the move. Wilson Contreras could be on the move. Javier Baez could be on the move, and even Anthony Rizzo could be on the move. It looks like they're not going anywhere right now, and as sentimental as I'm sure they are to that group of players, most of whom were on the World Series team in 2016, at some point, you know, reality just overwhelms you, and you say, hey, it's not our year, and the best thing that can be done for the future of this franchise is to make trades. So I think they'll be very busy, and I think they'll be taking lots of phone calls. And I think they'll restock their farm system, and that's really the it's painful in the short term, but in the long term, it's the smart way to play it.
And Dan, just looking at the AL East before we let you go here, you know, it seems like every story I read and every Yankees fan I see on social media, story I read out of the Bronx is it's like the world is ending, right? That the Yankee season has been a complete disaster, but then it's halfway through the season and they are tied with the Blue Jays in the standings, only a few games out of the wild card. What do you make of how the Yankees have played so far this year and how much of a threat they can be still in the AL East for the rest of the season?
I never want to count them out. I always think they can be a threat, but they have had a very disappointing season. And I think the Blue Jays are a better team. You know, if you look at run differential, which is just one way of looking at teams, and as you said, both teams are 3 games over .500. The Yankees' run differential is +1. The Blue Jays is +72. So that's some circumstantial evidence that suggests the Blue Jays are a better team than the Yankees. The Blue Jays have just found a way to lose a lot of close games, unfortunately. Like, I think we'd all agree the Blue Jays could easily be 3, 4, 5 games better than they are right now. I think the Yankees are flawed. You know, Chapman is really struggling right now. The offense has been very disappointing. They've got a lot of guys who do the same stuff, but they're not doing it very well right now. They're not a very athletic team. They don't have any speed at all. They're the worst base running team in baseball. They're not a great defensive team. You know, the names are bigger than what they're doing this year. The resumes are great, but the actual current performance isn't great. That having been said, like, guys, if you told me that coming out of the All-Star break, all of a sudden DJ LeMahieu and Gleyber Torres and Gary Sanchez turned it on and got hot, that can happen because they've all done it before. I don't think the Yankees are going to do anything crazy at the deadline. I think Brian Cashman will wait and see how, you know, the next week or 10 days go. And if they're on the fringes of it, if they're in it, I could see them making little moves around the edges. But I don't think they're going out and getting Max Scherzer or anything like that. I could be wrong. But I think reality's setting in a little bit with them as well, that this team may not be good enough to mortgage your future for, that no matter what they do, it might not be enough.
And Dan, one more question for myself before we let you go. Boston leads the division right now. Tampa Bay is 1.5 games back. We saw Tampa take 2 of 3 from the Jays this weekend. Of those two teams, who do you think is the better all-around team?
It's a good question because everybody keeps waiting for the Red Sox to kind of stub their toe and to come back to earth, and they haven't done it. You know, they can really hit. I mean, they've got 3 or 4 elite hitters on that team, and the pitching has held up. And Chris Sale is getting closer, and he could be back in some kind of a role in the next few weeks. That having been said, I am always, and I know Blue Jay fans just can't stand the Rays and hate anything positive about the Rays, but I'm a big believer in the whole program, the whole culture, everything they do. And they've got tremendous depth. They've got a bunch of pitchers who are hurt who are going to come back in the second half, and they're really smart. Like they plug people in roles where they are best suited to contribute. And you look at individual guys and you say, well, he's not that good or he's not that good, but the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, as they say, for the Rays by a wide margin. So if I had to pick between the pitchers coming back and my belief just in everything that they do there, I would say the Rays are the better team and have a better chance of winning the division.
Yeah, we'll see if Tampa Bay continues to be a thing going forward in fall again with the Tampa Bay Rays. Hey, Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Always appreciate your insight. Look forward to hearing your calls for the Blue Jays for the rest of the season, and I'm sure we'll talk to you down the road, but enjoy the Home Run Derby tonight and the All-Star game tomorrow.
All right, guys. Same to you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. That's Dan Schulman joining Rintoul and Sermon, of course, Sportsnet play-by-play announcer for the Blue Jays, among a bunch of other things we should put out there,
yeah,
Jamie.
He's
not
got,
just the Blue Jays.
He's got a lot in his plate, Schulman does.
He does.
He wears a lot of different hats, and he does exceptionally well at all of them.
He does do that. He's got me a little bit convinced the All-Star game should be fun tomorrow. You know, it is always fun. I know Ohtani's going to actually pitch and hit in that. Of course, Joe Maddon already made a phone call and said, yeah, like, he can do this. This is okay. We're going to have this happen. I do wonder, though. Like, I know he's going to be in the Home Run Derby. Like, the story came out that he just doesn't do batting practice, which I find completely insane, but I guess he's that good enough. He just sees the ball, doesn't want to have someone kind of slow tossing to him and just, you know, ruin his swing on.
Doesn't that
dish,
make
but,
you like, in a way, doesn't that make you almost more excited though? To
well, it makes me
it,
in
right?
awe.
Yeah,
of just pure talent. We saw it with Aaron Judge. I kind of understand why Vladdy's not going in it. It's the whole you take these many swings in batting practice and just to be the possibility of something, I'm not going to wear like my Debbie Downer hat here, but the possibility of something changing as the season goes on, just, you know, you get a little tired, fatigue, or you see something change because it's just, you haven't been doing this. Like you don't normally hit like 100 swings, right?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing with Ohtani though. Like the pace he's been on for the last month is ridiculous, right? And like, he's going to slow down at some point, but you know, just because he's going to slow down, you know, in August, we don't have to blame it on the Home Run Derby. You know what I mean? Like, he was always going to slow down from this pace, whether or not he does the Home Run Derby. So, you know what? Like, I understand the concerns, but let's just enjoy it. Like, he's going to do what he's going to do in the second half. It doesn't matter. Enjoy the show tonight, because I think it should be a good one.
Okay, I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to try and be positive about this. No more pessimism, which is where I tend to go when I talk about things. So, yes, I'll watch it with full intrigue, because I honestly want to see, like, he's hitting bombs out of Angels Stadium, and I want to see what he can do in Denver. Like, this is going to be stupid. Like, it's just going to be something. Can he hit 600 and something? I don't know. Yeah, we'll see if that can happen. We're going to switch a little gears coming up in the next hour. 1 hour in the books, 3 more to come, but we're going to talk some hockey, because we're going to run down kind of how the offseason works. Saturday is a very big day. It's when the NHL expansion protection lists have to be in. The GMs are having a meeting today virtually. They're getting the final kind of, remember, this is how expansion protection lists work and all that kind of thing. Not like they shouldn't know that already, Jamie, but they're getting that phone call today. We're going to talk Canucks and Flames. What does the ideal, or maybe just, what do you want to see happen this offseason with both of your teams? What will be successful? What will be ideal for both the Canucks and the Flames? 650, 650, 960, 960. We're going to talk about that next on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
It's about to get very busy in the NHL. Yes, a couple of key dates to keep your eye on over the next couple of weeks. And the first key date is this Saturday. Jamie, it's Rintoul and Suhrman. Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott Rintoul today. He will be back in the host chair tomorrow. A lot of work is what I have to say. A lot of work needs to be done by both the Vancouver Canucks and the Calgary Flames this offseason. You could probably argue those two teams have the most question marks of all the Canadian teams after this North Division season that they had last year. But let's just first run down the quick dates that people need to be aware of, because I think everyone should be aware by now that the expansion draft is due this Saturday. It's June 17th. Your protection list, should I say. And then it's the expansion draft next Wednesday. That's July 21st. The moratorium on trade and waiver freeze and signings is lifted. Then it's the entry draft 2 days later on Friday the 23rd, actually the same day the Olympics open. And final day to submit any qualifying offers to RFAs are on July 26th. And then it's free agency that is just a couple of weeks away now on July 28th. So everything's going to be coming pretty fast and furious in these next 3 weeks as we go up to July 28th. But you and I, Jamie, wanted to get into the fact that there's a lot of work to do, as we said, for the Vancouver Canucks and the Calgary Flames this offseason, but everything probably can't be done. Like, the laundry list of improving your team from the two last-place teams in that division, well, Ottawa's in there, I guess, last season, it's a long list. So what do ideal/successful offseasons look like for these two teams? Because you could look at it as ideal would be what you want, but successful could be, okay, they got 4 out of 6 things on their list, or 5 out of 6 things on their list, because ideally, you'd want all 6 things, but you can't get all 6 things.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. And you're right. I mean, neither of these teams is going to be transformed into a Stanley Cup contender this offseason, right? Like, I don't think that's a realistic expectation, or an expectation that, you know, either of the fan bases are really holding on to. It's just about, it's about having a good offseason. And, you know, I'll start with in Vancouver with the Canucks. And ideal, and we have people texting in, you know, they need a third line center, they need more top four defensemen. And that's all true. But look, maybe I'm setting the bar too low here, but for me, a successful Canucks offseason is just don't make any big mistakes, right? Like, don't screw anything up for the future of this team. Again, I know that's a very low bar. You probably want a little more from your favorite NHL team when summer rolls around, but this team is still dealing with the consequences of bad decisions made years ago, right? I think the number one priority should be to avoid repeating those mistakes. We can see in Vancouver the light at the end of the awful salary cap tunnel, right? Like, a lot of bad money is coming off the books right now. A ton more of it comes off next year. Try to actually put that flexibility to good use. Don't just waste it this summer, right? Don't repeat the mistakes of the past. For me, that's probably the job number one for the Canucks this year.
Yeah, and obviously you've been affected by usually what is July 1st. It'll be July 28th this season. That's the free agency, and I know exactly where you're coming from. I mean, Louis Erickson, it's so close to being off the books, but it's not quite yet off the books. Antoine Roussel, so close to being off the books. Same with Jay Beagle, but it's not quite there. The big one, I guess, that does kind of come off is the Brandon Sutter, but do they need him back? Do they want him back next season? I'm with you. It's not making the same mistakes, and I don't... Do you think Jim Benning has learned from past experiences because of the fact he has given out these, he's been roasted for these contracts, but does he even have the ability to make them this offseason with a flat cap? Like, I know he has to reinvent his bottom six, and that's another one of the check marks on the list of things that the Vancouver Canucks have to do, but he needs to reinvent it with different players and different contracts, like cheaper contracts, like what most teams, at least successful teams, have in their bottom six. Like, I don't even know if he does have the ability to keep repeating those mistakes.
Well, the concern is, I mean, we've heard from Jim Benning a couple times since the Canucks season ended, right? And I think the concern for a lot of fans is the one word he's used, which is aggressive, right? The team that he has said, the team plans to be aggressive, and you get the sense that, at least internally, there is pressure for the Canucks to really bounce back and make the playoffs next year, right? And I think, understandably so, a lot of fans are nervous about that because they hear the word aggressive, and they think that means going out and spending big in free agency. Now, I agree. It's not immediately clear to me that once they sign Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes that they're going to have a lot of cap space to work with to make those kinds of moves. Mm-hmm. I know Benning has said, well, you know, we have buyouts to use, and we can make some trades to free up some salary cap space. But I think that's the worry. Now, I will say, I think you can be aggressive without hurting your flexibility down the road, right? Like, I think that is possible. That's just a big challenge, and it's not really one we've ever seen Jim Benning successfully complete before, right? Like, it's possible. I just don't have a lot of confidence in this front office doing it.
Well, ownership hopefully does. Of course, he's got that 2 more years left on this deal to try and figure this out. But minor Matt in Abbotsford, Canucks ideal offseason. Text in to 650, 650 and get your text in. 960, 960 as well for Calgary. We'll get there momentarily. Number one is sign Pettersson and Hughes to long-term deals. Number two, don't commit any new money to bottom six wingers. If it's a good enough center, I'll allow it, he says. The Kraken select Holtby and unload Virtanen. I mean, the likelihood is when you look at what's going to happen with this protection list and the expansion drafts, I don't think it's going to be someone like a Braden Holtby, I think, unless the Vancouver Canucks somehow throw in some sort of sweetener. But do you want to throw in a sweetener at this point? Like, are you going to mortgage your future for a team that needs every asset that they have moving forward to better this team? I think it's probably going to be someone like a Zach McEwen that might be picked up by the Seattle Kraken, which is, I think, probably fine by Canucks fans. But they've got a laundry list, and I've said it before. It's clear cap space. You know, do they figure out a way to go after teams that are either capped out, cap issues before this expansion draft, or teams that have protection issues? Is that an avenue that Jim Benning figures out? Pettersson and Hughes do have to get signed. We have to see what those deals do look like. How long do those go on into the summer? Are they done quickly? I don't know what that is, but then you got to get a top four defenseman, and maybe two if Nate Schmidt all of a sudden decides that he wants out. And from all intents and purposes, we've heard that Elliot Friedman's latest 31 Thoughts recap said they're working to find a new home for Nate Schmidt. So if he's gone, that's another big hole on this roster. Like, it just seems to go down and down the list, and it's just like another thing. But what does successful look like for you? So, Jamie, you said successful looks like for you not repeating the past mistakes. Is there certain things that are top of your list that you would like to see happen first? And then maybe if they don't get to it, that's okay.
Well, look, obviously, the number one thing that's going to shape the future of the Canucks that happens this summer is what the new contracts for Pettersson and Hughes look like, right? So do well on those is number one with a bullet, right? Like, you have to get at least a decent deal on those, right? They can't be brutally player-friendly at the expense of the team. That's going to be really tough. Beyond that, you know, what I would say is find a bargain in free agency, right? Like, that has not been a forte of the Canucks in Jim Benning's tenure. They have struck out way more often than not in free agency. But, you know, I go back to something like the Thomas Vanek signing, right? Cheap. He was productive here. Then they flipped him at the deadline. Ended up, at the time, it was not viewed as a good trade, but it ended up getting Tyler Motte in town, and now he is a long-term contributor potentially to this team, right? So go bargain hunting. Find a guy, and whether it's someone like Vanek that you flip at the deadline or someone younger that ends up being a long-term piece for you, do that. Finally, don't get screwed again in free agency. Find a bargain, go bargain hunting, and hope that someone sticks. That would be my ideal step for the Canucks.
You've got fingers, you've got toes, you got everything crossed right now, Jamie. You're just waiting for it. Just go bargain hunting. Calgary Flames, a lot of question marks because it's about the core of this team, and it's about the fact that, you know, you've got a GM on the hot seat. You've also got a GM on record as saying there needs to be changes. And this is the reason why I had the Calgary Flames last week on Friday as one of my five teams that will define this offseason for the NHL, just because I think there has to be a ton of movement from this team. And I'm going to point to Eric Francis, has a wonderful article on sportsnet.ca right now talking about the 7 question marks about the Calgary Flames this offseason. And it's all going to start with their expansion draft for the Calgary Flames. Like, is there a big change in the fact that their captain is going to be picked up by Seattle? Like, that's the number one question mark with this team. And I guess the questions that surround that, Jamie, is does Brad Treliving, does Daryl Sutter want Giordano so much that they try and throw in some sort of sweetener with Ron Francis so they don't take Giordano? We already know that Milan Lucic is going to waive his no-move clause, but they're not likely going to take him. But if you are Seattle and you're looking at Calgary's roster, I don't know. Like, I think you want Mark Giordano. One, if you decide to keep him, 38 years old, he's still got a few very good years left in that body. But also, two, if you're Seattle, that's a very good flip prospect for you to another team.
Yeah, it really is, especially, you know, it's going to be so fascinating to see how Seattle manages their salary cap situation, because obviously, right now, they have nothing but cap space, right? But, you know, theoretically, if they take Mark Giordano, are they then comfortable retaining 50% of his salary and trading him into another team, because that boosts Giordano's values considerably, right? And to your point, then all of a sudden they have a really valuable trade asset in Mark Giordano. It could be an interesting move for Seattle. I wouldn't worry too much about that. I know he's been an emotional leader there in Calgary, but look, if they take him, they take him. He's only under contract for one more year. You can't stress out about it that much, right? I think you just kind of have to let the chips fall where they will and move on if you're the Calgary Flames. I wouldn't stress out and, you know, start sending Seattle other assets to make sure you get to keep Giordano. We saw how that worked out for teams in the Seattle or in the Vegas expansion draft, right? It didn't go well. I would not try to emulate that process if I was the Calgary Flames. You know, I actually think the Flames have a much more difficult job than the Canucks do this offseason. I said with the Canucks, the number one thing is just don't make any big mistakes. Like, theoretically, that should be relatively easy to accomplish. With the Flames, I mean, they need to basically remake their core group of players. That's a lot harder to do in one offseason.
And the question is with Johnny Gaudreau as well. And I mean, he's been talked about so much in this market. It was talked about up to the trade deadline, but everybody said basically, if this is a deal, it's going to get done. It's going to get done in the summer. He had a pretty decent, improved his play at least a little bit under Daryl Sutter. He was the leading scorer on this team, I believe, this past offseason. But if that's the case, that kind of says a bit more maybe about the rest of the roster construction versus Johnny Gaudreau. You have to make a decision on him. You have to make a decision on, are you going to keep him? And if you are going to keep him, you have to think about a long-term extension. How would that go over with this fan base? Or what can you get for him? And you have to trade him before July 28th. I'm sure Flames fans all understand this, and our listeners understand that when July 28th kicks in, Johnny Gaudreau has a lot of say in where he can go and where he can be traded. There's a five-team trade list that he can submit. So he can only be traded to five team at his choosing. That really ties Brad Living's hand as of July 28th. So I think that is the biggest, if the biggest question mark isn't Mark Giordano, and if he's going to be off to Seattle in expansion and you don't protect him, then I think obviously the next big one is, what do you do with Johnny Gaudreau ahead of July 28th?
And it's so tricky because it feels like, you know, we've talked about it so much, and I know Calgary has talked about it so much, right? The two guys that everyone looks at and says you got to trade these guys is Johnny Gaudreau and Sean Monahan, right? And right now, to the 960-960 Calgary inbox, we get a text saying, please get rid of Monahan. He's a pylon out there, right? That is a very common sentiment among Calgary Flames fans. The problem is, though, are you making a trade to get something good in return, or are you just making a trade for the sake of making a trade, right? And it concerns me because those two guys, their value is either at its lowest point right now or very near its lowest point around the league. So are you going to be able to win a Johnny Gaudreau or a Sean Monahan trade? Or is it worth it just making a deal, even if you don't win it, just for the sake of getting them off the books and resetting where the direction of your team? I don't know, but it's the kind of situation where if you're determined, say, we have to move one of these guys at least, no matter what, you could get yourself in a really tough position there where you make a bad trade and it actually sets you back rather than moving you forward.
And when you think about Johnny Gaudreau, I think he's probably the biggest asset, because you can point to a 99-point season a few years ago. Like, I don't know if he's fully lost that. Like, it still could be there. It just needs a change of scenery. Again, this all comes down to who's a Daryl Sutter guy and who isn't, right? Like, honestly, it's what's your best trade chip, but then what does Daryl Sutter think about these players? He was brought in for a reason midseason, and there's something that was wrong in the locker room to start the year, and Daryl was brought in to change it. And is Johnny Gaudreau a guy that does fit into a system? He said, his year in press conference, Jamie, he said, I want to be here. I love the city. I love the organization. This is where I want to be. They are the team that drafted me, the team that gave me my first NHL shot, a kid that people thought was too undersized to be able to play in today's NHL, and he flourished for parts of his career. I do think, though, it's like, but if you're Calgary, like, it has to be done before July 28th, because you can't go into next season with Johnny Gaudreau on the final year of his deal with no extension and then just have him walk away from nothing. Cause that, it would be a massive failure in terms of what Brad Treliving did as a general manager.
Yeah, that would be really, really tough to swallow. We got this text comes in to 960-960, the Calgary inbox, saying sometimes cap relief is better than the player you get back. So yeah, trade Monahan for some used practice jerseys. I get it. I really do. Like, I understand, hey, you think he's overpaid, he's not living up to his role. That's all fair. But he's still playing an important
position on your team, right? Mm-hmm. And if you just move him with no clear replacement strategy, that's a recipe for the Flames taking a step backwards. Maybe you're okay with that. Maybe you're fine with the team taking a step backwards because you think it will pay off in the long run. But I still just think both of those potential deals, whether you're talking about Monahan, whether you're talking about Gaudreau, those are hard trades for the Flames to win, given the position they're in.
I texted with someone yesterday, in the industry, and I said, what is a successful offseason for you to look like for the Calgary Flames? They said, turning Johnny Gaudreau and Matthew Tkachuk into a 1-2 center. Just as simple as that. And I'm thinking, well, it's not as simple as that. That seems to be a little bit, that's a drastic move, if you're going to move on from Matthew Tkachuk. But we'll have to see. Both of these teams have incredibly important offseasons to appease their fan bases, but also to make, you know, you're signing some pretty young players in Vancouver. You got to appease those guys moving forward. And then for the Calgary Flames, you just have to see if you can make any sort of adjustments to this core going forward. 960-960-650-650. Keep texting us in. Let us know what you think successful off-seasons, ideal off-seasons would be for the Calgary Flames and the Vancouver Canucks. But Greg, let's get to what they're saying. Here is what they are saying. We talked a lot off the top of the show, Jamie, about England's fall from grace, not being able to win the European Championship at Wembley at home after having that early lead. But the question does remain, like, how much blame should Gareth Southgate get for a lot of these decisions that he made tactically? We've talked about the substitutions. We talked about what he did with the five kickers in the penalty kicks. But Craig Burley with ESPN FC, he weighed in on just that earlier today.
Lots. Because they were too negative. I mean, they were super negative in this final. I mean, the criticism of him in his tenure has been he's too pragmatic. Now, it's brought them an element of success in terms of a semi-final and now a final, but ultimately there's no trophy. Mm. But the pragmatism came back to haunt them because pragmatism became negativity. It became defensive. It became lacking cohesion. It became ball retention was terrible. Maguire just pumping it up the field. Yep. Long balls to Harry Kane. And you look at the team and you look at the squad and you look at the offensive players they have, and they had no Phil Foden today. They were super negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the best team that they faced in the competition, right? We know England had a pretty easy pathway-ish. People will shout at the TV, Germany. Germany were not the same team. Jürgen Love should have been sacked after the 2018 debacle. He wasn't. They were never the same team. But England still had to do a job on them. They did. But look at the changes he made. You know, we saw the two guys taking the penalty. There was 3-2 penalties, substitute Saka, Sancho, Rashford. Sancho and Rashford came on. In fact, at one point there was a concern if Italy didn't put the ball out, they might not have got on the field.
Yeah.
That's how late and how negative. In fact, Southgate had to make the changes along with Kyle Walker on a corner kick for Italy. That's how desperate it was to get them on the field. That's a big no-no, right? But what I'm saying is, he made those changes for penalties only. He didn't make a change before that to bring on a Sancho to win the game.
Yeah.
Why didn't that's he? Negative. Why didn't he was frightened. He was frightened.
And that's obviously a pretty harsh assessment, right? Calling him frightened at the end. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of England supporters would feel the same way right now. It's so mm-hmm. tough because, as Craig Burley said in that clip, right, they have had success under Southgate. Yeah, they haven't claimed a title, but they've gotten a lot farther mm-hmm. than they have in decades, right? But you look at this iteration of the England squad in particular, they had so much attacking talent, and it felt like Gareth Southgate was just so reluctant to actually use that talent.
I mean, when you come out of the group stage, you only scored a couple of goals, but you're two wins and one draw. I mean, that's fine. You got the first spot in that group, and going forward, they didn't seem to have. It was like as soon as they got that goal, and we've talked about it, it was so early. They just went so defensively, and at some point, you can't think to yourself, you're going to hold an 87-minute lead against this Italian squad. This is the World Cup final. Like, this is not, you know, you're playing, I don't know, Martinique or something like that to throw Canada. A reference out there, like, this is a team that has not lost in 32 straight matches going in. They rarely concede a goal, so I just don't understand why you think tactically it remains smart just to stand on that back foot and let Italy bring it to you and move it to you going forward for 87 minutes of the match that ended up being another half an hour added on. So I don't know. He's going to take a lot of criticisms. Gareth Southgate. We'll talk to James Sharman in about an hour's time to get his take on it. I wanted to get this one in as well, Jamie, because we haven't discussed it, but it was a monumental day in England altogether yesterday. Early in the morning, it was Novak Djokovic taking on Matteo Berrettini to win the Wimbledon men's title. It's his sixth Wimbledon title, and now his 20th overall, ties him with Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal for the most all time, and he commented on that after the match.
Look, I've mentioned this before many times, and I have to pay a great tribute to Rafa and Roger. They are legends of our sport, and they are, you know, the two most important players that I ever faced in my career. They are, I think, the reason that I am where I am today. They've helped me realize what I need to do in order to improve, to get stronger mentally, physically, tactically. When I broke into the top 10 for the first time, I lost for 3-4 years most of the big matches that I played against these two guys, and you know, something shifted end of 2010, beginning of 2011. And last 10 years has been an incredible journey that is not stopping here.
And Jamie, I don't think it is stopping. And what he said, at the time of the 2011 Wimbledon, which Djokovic won, he had won 3 majors. Nadal had 10, Federer had 16. 10 years later, 2021 Wimbledon, Federer has 20, Nadal has 20, Djokovic has 20. He's won 17 majors in 10 years.
It's an incredible just moment in time for tennis fans, right? To have all three of them on 20 at the same time. It feels like inevitable that Djokovic is going to move ahead of them, right? At the U.S. Open coming up later this summer. You never know, but it feels like that is certainly going to be the case. But it really is just to have the three greatest men's tennis players of all time all tied at 20 majors right now. And you always hear the respect between the three of them, how much they respect each other. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible accomplishment. It's incredible, as I said, moment in time for tennis fans.
Yeah, it's just, I don't think it's something in our lifetimes, we'll probably never see again. Hopefully we've got about 30 or 40 more years at least to go in our lifetimes, Jamie. But I just don't
I'm
think
hoping
it's
for more
something...
than 30, Karen. I'm hoping for more than 30 here. We'll see.
Sorry, I'd be a little pessimistic. 50, 60, we'll go from there. I guess I'm kind of dating myself. I'll only be 68 in 30 years. Yeah, hopefully living a little bit longer past that. But my point is I don't, it's a long time left to go, but I don't think we're ever going to see this again because it's the dominance of three players at one time, and then add Serena Williams on the women's side. And it's just been, I feel very privileged that I got to live in this era. You know how big a tennis fan I am. I know you love tennis as well. And it's just like to be able to have watched what these three have been able to do. And then the young crop coming up, I get it. There will be a changing of the guard at some point, but I don't think Novak Djokovic is going to let that happen in the next couple of years. Like he just looks to have, he's so healthy. He's so dominant right now. I just feel like he has at least 3-4 more majors in 3-4 more years to go.
No, I mean, he certainly didn't look vulnerable in the semifinals or the finals at Wimbledon, right? Like, did not look like that changing of the guard. I mean, we're seeing it with Federer, obviously, now. We're seeing it with Nadal a little bit now as well. With Djokovic, it's, I'm not sure when it's going to start, really.
And let's just point this out, too. He can win the calendar Grand Slam. If he wins the U.S. Open, that's going to come up. Rod Laver's the only other gentleman to do that. He can also win the Golden Slam. The Olympics are just around the corner, and he is one of the players that is going to be playing at the Olympics. He's won the bronze back in 2008, but never captured that gold medal. Okay, coming up, we're going to stick with some hockey. We're going to talk about what's been going on around the NHL. Duncan Keith, is he actually going to Edmonton? I have no idea at this point. But we're going to ask Mark Spector next, senior columnist with Sportsnet.ca and Sportsnet. He is coming up next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Unreal! All the people right here, unreal. Love them all. Let's party hard. Our time, baby. Back to back. That's how we do it.
What do you think of this team?
Unbelievable. Nobody can beat us. Back to back years. You know, it's an unreal team. Everybody was playing hard. You know, I wish we could keep everybody, but that's business. You know, but you know, as of right now, let's party hard. Let's enjoy it. We deserve it.
And in Tampa, there's a boat parade. No regular parades. We get on boats. How do you like that?
Unreal. I think nobody else done that before. It's unreal. Look how many people here, how many people on the ball. It's just unreal.
Well, congratulations, guys.
It's just unreal, Jamie. It's unreal. It's unreal. That was Nikita Kucherov, Rintoul, and Sermon. Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott Rintoul today. He will be back tomorrow as regular scheduled programming. But Jamie, the Tampa Bay Lightning are holding their championship boat parade right now. And I don't think Nikita Kucherov has stopped ingesting Bud Light since he won the Cup post-game press conference.
What? I mean, I don't even know how to begin calculating this, but like how many Bud Lights has Nikita Kucherov consumed from post-game Wednesday night to this morning at the boat parade in Tampa? It's a big, big number. It's a big number.
The best part about all of this is like, I mentioned this when it just had happened and he had just done his post-game press conference. If you were to do, like, a speech, like, you know, it's like, pick a guy out of the lineup. If you were to pick, like, a speech guy out of a lineup, would you even know what he sounds like? His voice?
No.
Like, he's
no,
just someone you
not.
He never speaks to the media. If he does, it's very guarded, just because I get it. Like, Russian is his first language. English is his second language. It seems like his English is getting a lot better over the last couple of days. People are interviewing him a lot more. Maybe he just doesn't have the apprehension of speaking in English because he has the alcohol flowing through his system.
Liquid courage, I believe.
Liquid courage, yes. I have the question, though. This is the biggest question I have. Because can he outdo Ovi? Both Russian, you know, both apparently know how to party. We saw Ovi's summer with the Cup was the most epic thing that I've probably ever seen. Thank God for social media that was out there in the world. But Nikita Kucherov, do you think he can outdo Ovi?
I mean, he's going to challenge him, right? Like, he's on an early path to challenge him. But the thing with Ovi and the Capitals was it sustained for so long, right? You know, it kept going and going. That's going to be Kucherov's challenge. Because right now, he's on track to surpass Ovechkin. But does he have the stamina? Can he keep it up for weeks and weeks into the summer?
We're going to speak with Mark Spector coming up. And no, we won't talk about Nikita Kucherov's partying all summer and if that can actually happen. Maybe we'll ask him about that. But it was funny because when Ovi won the Cup, it just seemed that Ovi always had the Cup. Like, I don't know how many other Washington Capitals player actually got it in the summer. I'm sure they all did. That did its normal tour, Jamie, like it always does in the summer. But it just seemed like everywhere that the Cup went, Ovi was with it. It's like, nope, this is mine. I want it. I know you guys did too, but I'm just going to, you know, take it for the majority of the time because I don't want to let it go.
Well, and it's interesting because this time, obviously, it's back-to-back for Tampa Bay, right? As Nikita Kucherov is reminding everyone on his little media tour right now. So it's almost, it's less emotional, I think, than it was for the Capitals because they had tried for so hard, so long to overcome and get over the hump of winning the Cup. It's less emotional almost for the Tampa Bay Lightning and more just pure joy and pure celebration right now.
Well, and that's the thing. And this year, you know, like last year it was a weird celebration. I almost felt weird at happening, the boat parade, because we knew where the COVID pandemic was, the non-vaccines, and what was going on in Florida. So I feel a little bit kind of more comfortable watching this one. We still know it's going down south of the border, but hopefully they get to enjoy it again this summer. We're joined now by Mark Spector, senior columnist for Sportsnet.ca and Sportsnet. Mark, how are you doing? Are you feeling as good as Nikita Kucherov has felt since they won the Stanley Cup?
Well, it's pushing 11:30 here in Edmonton, okay. So no, I'm not hammered yet, if that's what you're asking. I'm still writing a piece, so we do try to stay sober until at least we file.
I appreciate you doing that and coming on air and being that way as well. It's funny seeing the seams out of Tampa Bay because I don't know about you, but last year it was still, I mean, just we knew where we were in the pandemic and just kind of how where the U.S. was politically, shall we say, and it was uncomfortable to watch the parade. It's still a little to me uncomfortable just knowing what's going on south down there, but I do hope that it was just like these players get to celebrate it a lot more probably than they did last year, and I hope they deserve it. I mean, this Tampa Bay, what they did was almost historic.
Yeah, I would listen. Not many teams winning two in a row, and you know what they do? It's this, they deserve it a little bit. Like when you won that pandemic cup in the bubble here in Edmonton, I remember being there and they're parading the cup around the ice and you can hear every voice on the ice because there's none off of it. Then they came home and they have a parade. They haven't seen their fans in forever. You know, it's fall. There's barely a break before we started the new season. They didn't get to have the cup the way a normal team does. So frankly, Tampa kind of got ripped off last year and the whole, all the ancillary things that come with winning a Stanley Cup that are so much fun and so memorable. So good for them. No one gave them this cup. They're the best team in the league. They earned every second of it. And now they're going to have a proper sort of summertime to enjoy it. Good for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to start, Mark, with the news of the day, and that's coming out of Ottawa. Pierre McGuire has been named the new senior VP of player development for the Ottawa Senators. First off, my initial thoughts were interesting move. What were your initial thoughts on McGuire being back in the NHL and, of course, not in the broadcasting role now?
Yeah, my thoughts are less about Pierre McGuire, who, you know, he's knows a lot about the game, knows a lot of people in the game. He's very, very close to the game. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of a lot of players, and I'm not going to come on there here and tell you that he can't get the job done. Let's see it. Mm-hmm. Let's wait and let's watch and let's give him a chance to do the job. That's fine. What struck me originally was this appears to be an ownership hire here. You know, I didn't see any quotes from Pierre Dorion talking about how he interviewed a bunch of guys for this job and Pierre McGuire was the best candidate. I saw a story of the Ottawa Sun with Eugene Melnick telling me, you know, about what a great job Pierre McGuire is going to do, and that's fine. But saying other things like, the rebuild's over, we're through this thing, we're ready to compete, it's go time. This smells a lot like an owner that's making a move, you know, over the head and behind the back of the general manager, frankly. Forcing an employee on a general manager that should be a general manager's hire, not an owner's hire. You know, we've watched Ottawa for years now. 98% of the dysfunctionality in that franchise comes via Eugene Melnick. So when he makes a hire like this and comes out and says all the things he said about how, you know, we're so far ahead in our rebuild and we're...
Nope.
Sorry, Elliot Friedman phoning me. I'll ask the people in Vancouver, you know, how fast does the rebuild really come? I'll ask the people in Edmonton, did it happen in 2 years for you? But somehow in Ottawa, we're claiming the rebuild's over and this team's competitive, and I smell a bit of a rat there, I'm afraid.
Well, and Mark, that seems to always be the case in Ottawa, right? When they do get on a bit of a positive track and they finally get some good news around that franchise, it seems like Eugene Melnick is the guy who does something to derail that. And to your point, yeah, they had a nice season, better season than expected, but it's a little early to be, you know, throwing up the mission accomplished banner and saying that the rebuild is over already.
Well, listen, I covered Edmonton team that beat them, I think, in all 9 games last year. Is that how many they played?
Yep.
I think it was 9.
Yep.
And they weren't ready. Like, they didn't have goaltending. Their defense was weak. It's a nice team. They've got some good players. Like, you know, Brady Tkachuk, you build a franchise around them. Well, they better, you know, don't tell me your rebuild's done until you sign this kid long term. And there seems to be a bit of an issue there, right? So don't tell me your rebuild's done until we find out if Matt Murray's a goalie or not, because we're not sure. So there's some good players. Like, they got some Thomas Chabot, and they've got a handful of nice guys there. I like their team, and I like what they're doing. But listen, call me jaded after watching an Oilers rebuild that's maybe 20 years in. You don't just do a rebuild in 2 years and proclaim yourself ready to go. Not when you played hockey the way the Senators did for 2/3 of the season. Sure, they finished strong in games that didn't matter, right? We've all watched our teams finish strong in seasons where there's no pressure and the points don't mean anything. It's easy to win those games. You know, Senators won a bunch of games that didn't matter. Talk to me when you start winning games that matter.
Mark, as you mentioned, you know, you're locked in on the Edmonton Oilers. The big storyline in Edmonton over the last week or so has been whether they're going to go out and make a deal for Duncan Keith. What's your sense of where talks between the Oilers and the Blackhawks stand on Duncan Keith right now?
Well, I think it's gaining steam. Here's what we got. In my opinion, I've done, you know, made my calls. I don't think Stan Bowman has a second team to trade Duncan Keith to. I think he's got a player who's asked for a trade, a player who, after what he's given to the Blackhawks organization, after the number he took, you know, $5.5 million is a lot for Duncan Keith today, you might say, but for the majority of that contract, he's been a heck of a buy for the Chicago Blackhawks, right? He, this guy might be a Hall of Fame defenseman. He's won 3 cups there. He'll certainly be on their Ring of Honor or whatever they call it. So Stan Bowman has to trade this player. The player wants to go to one of 4 towns, Vancouver, Calgary, Seattle, or Edmonton. Vancouver's not taking him. Calgary has 4 defensemen making over $4.5 million, I believe. Or is it $4 million, one of the two? Plus an aging Mark Giordano, who's their highest paid defenseman. So they don't need a 38-year-old guy making $5.5 million. So I think Stan Bowman has one team to trade Duncan Keith to, and I know that he's asked, Elliot Friedman reported the other day, he was asking for Ryan Malone or Ethan Bear in return. And if I'm Ken Holland in Edmonton, I'm here to tell you, I'm taking this player you have to get rid of. He's making 5.5. I want the player because Duncan Keith can still play. And Edmonton, with Oscar Klefbom being hurt, they're dying for a second-pairing left defenseman here to play with Adam Larson. So Keith's a nice fit in Edmonton, but it's all about the return. It's all about what you have to give to the Blackhawks and if there is, who's retaining salary and what's going on there. So I suspect that Ken Holland has put his offer in Stan Bowman's hands last week, and I suspect Stan Bowman fished around looking for a better deal somewhere else and can't find it, and I suspect he'll be coming back to Edmonton pretty quickly, and you're trying to make the deal a little better on his end. But we're going to have a yay or nay on this thing pretty quick, in my opinion.
And, Mark, you mentioned the fit potentially on the ice with Keith pairing up with Adam Larson on the second pairing. How much of Edmonton's interest in Keith is about that fit on the ice, and how much of it is about his pedigree as a winner in the NHL and being able to add a veteran like that to the locker room in Edmonton?
Well, both things. And you know, here's where we get, and I'm sure many of our listeners right now fit into this group. You know, the analytics crowd and the people that really fancy the numbers don't have that much respect for things that you cannot measure numerically, right? You know, leadership, things that you know, having Edmonton's got a couple of prize young defensemen here in Evan Bouchard and Philip Broberg. You know, have a couple of years playing with Duncan Keith. Would you think that would help a young player? I suspect it would, but that'll never make the spreadsheet. So, you know, the player has to be able to play, folks. That's where we're at. We know this with Louis Erickson. We know this with Milan Lucic, right? You can't just bring in a guy from Boston because he's won some cups. If he can't play, it doesn't work, right? We know this for sure. So Duncan Keith, by all reports, can still play. He spent his whole season with young defensemen on a bad team with horrible goaltending, and his numbers aren't great. Bring him to Edmonton, which is a much better team, and you're playing with a guy like Adam Larson, who is a veteran, stay-at-home, steady rock guy, and it is my belief that you'll like Duncan Keith's numbers a whole lot more. And then you throw in the things that, you know, this young leadership group in Edmonton that's never won anything, and I will point out, has lost 7 of its last 8 playoff games. There's clearly, you know, they're good on the ice, they're good in the regular season, but there's some steps to be made in the playoffs. Having a guy like Duncan Keith around to kind of solve that nut, I'm not sure how it could hurt.
We're speaking with Mark Spector, senior columnist for Sportsnet.ca and Sportsnet, here on Rintoul and Sermon with Jamie Dodd filling in for Scott Rintoul today. Mark, going down the QE2 there, Brad Treliving's been on record saying, we're going to change, we have to change. He's on record that he has to make some moves this offseason. When you look at this Calgary Flames roster, what does some sort of successful summer look like for Treliving and the organization?
Oh, it's hard in Calgary. I agree with Brad, and I know Brad's a smart guy and a good GM. And he's also been pretty bold, you know. He's made some good trades. Like, he moved Dougie Hamilton, and that's a hard trade to make because Dougie Hamilton's a really good player. And he got back Lindholm and Hanifin, and, you know, he made a nice deal there. I like Brad Treliving's work to an extent, but he's in a tough spot, and in my opinion, this is why. Major change in Calgary includes one of Johnny Goodrow or Sean Monahan. And mm-hmm. In Calgary, their value is exceptionally high. There are star players on their team. They're important players. But what they're finding out is if those two guys are two-thirds of your first line, you're not good enough because Calgary's not good enough. So the interest for Johnny Goodrow, Treliving's had Goodrow on the market not just this summer, folks. He's been on the market for some while. And the nut for Brad Treliving is this. He might need to trade the player. Let's use Johnny Goodrow as an example. You know, he might need to trade the player, and that's fair. But then you need to look at your fan base and say, well, here's what I got for him, and we think it's a good deal. He's not getting mm-hmm. back something that his fan base is going to like. They're not going to be satisfied in Calgary. So it's a hard place for a GM to be in. It's kind of like trading Jake Virtanen, right? You spend a fourth-round pick in the guy, and you want some commensurate return. Well, guess what? There's only one market in the world that looks at Jake Virtanen as a fourth overall pick anymore, right? The rest mm-hmm. of them just look at him as an okay player. So they're in that spot in Calgary. he needs to take some lumps to make this team better. And when you're Brad Treliving and you've been the general manager there for, I think it's 7 seasons now, and you're kind of starting over a little bit, it's hard to take those lumps and be sure you're going to have a job at the end of it sometimes.
Do you take calls on Matthew Tkachuk at all, your Brad Treliving?
Well, that starts with the Tkachuk camp. You know, something went sour with Matt Tkachuk in Calgary last year. It started with the puck tossing incident in Toronto. I think it was a Jake Muzzin. And Matt Tkachuk kind of went away for the last however many games that was. Was it a third to a half of the year? His whole attitude, his whole abrasiveness, his instigatingness all went away. So it starts with Tkachuk. I want Tkachuk on my team no matter who I am. If I'm Calgary, I need him on my team because I still think he's probably the best player. So I know people don't like Matt Tkachuk, and I get all that. I think Matt Tkachuk, I'd have him on my team every day. I don't get better by moving Matt Tkachuk out of town. But if Matt Tkachuk doesn't want to be there, and if Matt Tkachuk is not going to re-sign with me when his contract is up, then I need to start to – the time to deal him is when his value is at the highest. And if I'm turning this thing over in Calgary, and I know that Matt Tkachuk isn't going to be with me long-term, maybe now's the time to do it. That's another hard trade because, boy, they love him in Calgary, the fans. I mean, he is the fan favorite there. And, you know, it's I'm not saying he's Sedin. I'm not saying that. But it's like go trade Pettersson and see what your fans think of you. Go trade Draisaitl and see what your fans think of you. You know, you want to sell tickets in the same year you're trading out Goodrow and Tkachuk? Oh, boy, man. That's a tall order in Calgary.
Well, and I think one of the, you know, commonalities between the Flames and the Canucks this offseason, Mark, is trying to restore confidence from the fans, right? Which has been broken a little bit, certainly in Vancouver. And what we've heard from Jim Benning is he plans to be aggressive. He wants to get this team back to the playoffs next year. Do you think that's a realistic goal for the Canucks, given the really difficult season they just had?
Yeah, I think this was a bit of a blip this season for Vancouver. They were worse. You know, it went worse than it should have been. Then their talent would tell me it would go. You know, I look at the two franchises. Like, I get it. It's easy. Listen, I'm going to repeat this. I'm in Edmonton, so you don't have to tell me about rebuilds that take three times longer than they're supposed to. Right? The Oilers drafted Taylor Hall in 2010, and that was supposed to be the start of this big rebuild. It's 2021, and here's, you know, they still can't win a playoff game. So I get it. But look at the Canucks. Like, the Canucks have Pettersson. You know, he's better than any young forward Calgary has. The Canucks have Quinn Hughes, better than any young defenseman that they have. The Canucks have Demko, too. To me, I believe it's a very nice young goalie that's going to improve into a guy you can, you know, unless something goes funny, like with a Matt Murray, I like Demko as my long-term guy. You know, the Canucks have Bo Horvat, who is, you know what, on a championship team, he's probably a second-line center, but he's a damn good one and a hard player and a productive, good player. You know, they got a sniping winger in Besser. I get it. He didn't have a great year last year, but there's a really good player there. You know, they're bringing in this Hoglander who had a fabulous year. Like, there's a ton there of good, young, youthful guys that are all going to improve. I look at Calgary, and they don't have any of that stuff. You know, they got Rasmus Anderson. The point is a nice player. You know, the better players up front are a little bit older. They've been around for a while. So, you know, can Vancouver make the playoffs? Absolutely they can. It's very difficult, as we saw with the Jay Beagles. You know, people didn't like the JT Miller signing. He's been a pretty good player in Vancouver. Sometimes you get it wrong when you sign those complimentary veterans. It's not that easy to get that right. I've watched it in a lot of towns, and sometimes those are hard to do. You know, you bring in the wrong guy, and you're stuck with him for a while. So, yeah, if Jim Benning can just do a little more around the edges, you know, find another JT Miller for a little less money, he's going to need defensemen in there. I still like Tyler Myers a lot. So, yeah, there's a good team there, and I don't think they're far off.
Hey, Mark, I want to just thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you. I know you've got that column, and you got to phone Elliot Freeman back. I'm sure he's got some scoopage for you. So thank you so much for right? Thank you so much for joining us today. It's going to be a busy off-season next couple of weeks. It's silly season, but it's also going to be pretty fun, I think.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks, Mark. That is Mark Spector, senior columnist for Sportsnet.ca and Sportsnet. It's always intriguing, Jamie, if you're somebody and you're like, oh, it's Elliot Friedman on the phone. What has he got for me?
Yeah, I was going to say, I was almost like, hey, take the call and then call us back with the scoop from Friedman there.
I should have done that.
Let's hear it. I love it.
I should have done that. It's he's right. I mean, like, you look at the work that Ken Holland has to do with the Edmonton Oilers this season. Defense is a big thing, but is Duncan Keith the guy you want? Oscar Klefbom's not going to be healthy for the start of the season for everything that we understand, and I don't even know what his health is moving forward. Like, the shoulder surgery was pretty significant. Everything I've heard or read, it seems it's going in the right direction, his recovery, but I mean, it's not ideal for them, so what do? He's also got a ton of RFAs he's got to sign, plus just free agents, like a ton of work up there, but he has space to do it, right? Like, he's got some cap flexibility. When you look at the Canucks and you look at this Calgary Flames team, it's all about moving, well, for Vancouver at least, it's all about moving bad money out, but Calgary needs some flexibility as well, too, and what do you do with that core? So it's all, like, two of the teams within the Western Canadian Pacific Division are more equal, I think, than the other one. I think we can agree with that.
And just before we get back into that discussion, Karen, I mean, we were speculating why Elliot Friedman might have been calling Mark Spector during that interview, and we have a tweet from Elliot Friedman who says, hearing today that Chicago and Edmonton are closing in on the Duncan Keith deal. It may take time, but progress was made in the weekend. So I think we got a pretty good idea of why Friedman might have been reaching out to Mark Spector there. And that matches what Spector was saying, right? Which is that Chicago's in a really tough spot. They know they have to make this deal with Edmonton, and eventually it's going to happen. And now we have Elliot Friedman, Sportsnet's insider, reporting that they are closing in on a Duncan Keith deal.
There you go. I guess Stan Bowman went around the NHL and realized, yeah, there's not much more interest on Duncan Keith out there or wherever else he could go and try and find another trade partner. So it looks like, yes, Duncan Keith to Edmonton could be coming pretty soon. Okay, 2 hours in the books, two more to go. We're going to talk a lot of NHL coming up around the corner. You're listening to Rink Tool and Sermon with Jamie Dodd filling in on the Sportsnet Radio Network.